So I want to start. I'm very happy that Ben gave the talk yesterday because it provides a perfect background for the talk that I'm giving. And I wanted to start off with a couple of pictures and movies to demonstrate, you know, as a kind of advertisement for the rest of the talk. So Ben talked about learning receptor fields using sparse coding principles, and that was introduced by Bruno Olshausen in 1996. When I saw his paper, I thought, this is a job for independent component analysis, right? Because at that time we were using it for everything else, and it just looked like that was the theory. That was kind of implicit in Bruno's theory, was the idea that, you know, these cells are trying to find independent jobs. You know, there's the images coming in, and each cell wants to find an independent job to do, and they don't want to replicate each other's jobs. They want to, you know, like split the job up, and I'll take care of big edge detectors over here. You take care of little ones over here. And quite quickly, a year after the 97 paper, Hans van Hatteren and Dan Ruderman did this demonstration where they took natural movies. I just want to show you this. They put in natural movies into like these kind of things. They'd take these movies and they would segment them. They would segment them into little 12 by 12 by 12 vectors, or 12 by 12 by 12, you know, sort of little basis movies, or little, you know, well, basically, I'll show you. You know, the 12 by 12 images with 12 frames. So they would, so it would be things like this. Oops, here we go. Things like these. These are, you can't really see much in these, but these are like little 12 frame movies with like, which are 12 by 12. So they had like 12 cubed inputs to a network. So spread out in a big vector, you've got your 12 cubed inputs, whatever 12 cubed is. And you put the whole thing through a big matrix, a big square matrix, and you get 12 to the 6 parameters to transform it, and you get 12 cubed outputs. Actually, that's not what they did, because that's what you do if you did the whole ICA. They basically did a partial ICA, which was with the one that was developed by Apu Hyvärinen, where you can pull them out sort of one at a time.
How many pixels in each of the little
cube? In each of the little thing, there's 12 by 12, which is 144.
Only?
Yeah.
So this is just a randomly chosen 12 by 12?
Yeah, this is like, we're going to sample little 12 frame movies from these movies, and they're going to be 12 by 12 pictures. So there's not, you can't see much in these. This is a very small thing, you know. But, you know, computer power, he already was using a Cray to do this, you know, and I was amazed that he even did that, because at that time we were waiting around for the best part of a day to converge a network which had 300 inputs. So to have 12 cubed inputs was just amazing. And what he got out of it, you know, to follow up from what Ben showed yesterday, is these things, spatiotemporal basis functions. So these, what these are like the weight. They're like the. We're imagining that these movies are made up of linear combinations of these space-time functions, basically, and these are the weights that we're learning when we train on these movies over and over again, and you always get that they're localized, oriented, and moving perpendicular to the axis of their orientation, and the spatial frequency distribution that you get from this movie database much better matches what you get in V1 than what you get if you just stick these static images in. So this was they had a series of two papers. The first one was a more detailed study than what I did on this, on the match between ICA basis functions and V1. Oh, sorry, and these things here are the filters. So there's two kinds of things. I'll describe it later. One is the basis functions, the functions that make up the movies. Another is the functions that you have to use to extract the underlying causal factors from the movies, or the underlying underlying independent variables.
What is the connection between these filters and the underlying
images? So it's actually on a future slide, but it basically works like this. If this is the observed stuff, right, these are the movies. And these are like the latent variables or the hidden variables. We're imagining that, you know, this is like some hidden variable in the world that is how much, you know, a vertical bar in this place is, you know, This is like an independent cause, as it were. And we imagine that each independent cause gets multiplied by a basis function to give a component of the image. So the image is a linear superposition of these independent independent causes. So this is what we're watching when we're looking at the movies. These functions here, this is a vector, but it's a spatiotemporal function, are the fat ones that you saw before, the basis functions. These ones here are the sort of skinny ones that you're looking at now, which are the filters. So the basis and the filters are different. And the whole thing is written like this. You can say that in order to extract the independent components, you multiply by a matrix of filters W. In order to form the image, you multiply by a matrix of basis functions. But you really want that these U's that you output, these independent variables, are the same as the hidden intrinsic independent variables that are hidden in the data. So you want U to be an estimate of S, and you want W to be the inverse of A. Now, if this was an orthogonal transform, orthonormal transform, like principal component analysis or a Fourier transform, then the inverse of the matrix, the inverse of the basis function matrix would just be its transpose, right? So these functions would look the same, but this basis set is not an orthogonal basis set, so that's why they don't look the same. But they look kind of the same. You know, these ones look like spatially differentiated versions. The filters look like spatially differentiated versions of the basis functions. Yes.
The basic assumption for the starting thing is everything is linear.
Yes.
Like,
yes.
But we have natural images, a lot of non-linear.
Yes, yes. Like, yes, that's what the rest of the talk is about.
Okay.
And have you looked about just whether it's just like these things are space-time separable? Or is it, you know, and then could you get these, is it like a spatial component and a temporal component, or is it all confused?
In this space-time simulation, we treat space and time as just one big vector. We're putting the whole space-time thing in as one big vector. Well, there's various different people have worked on, you know, doing spatial analysis or a temporal analysis or some kind of mixture of the two of them, but I don't have anything to say about that, really.
And they look more like waves. They look more like things that would be a function of kx minus omega t, more than a function of x times a function of t. They look more like something moving through.
There might just be a space.
What the filters do?
Yeah.
Actually, if you look at the temporal dummy, if you feed, there is a complete, and you feed it in time, there's completely symmetric. But if you look at the response of the V1, or if you flip it, completely unsymmetric. Like if you look at the DeAngelis paper for a special temporal pocket of the V1 response,
right,
separable cell,
right,
they have a huge unsymmetry.
Oh, right.
Like they have a time to peak, and very fast, like 17 milliseconds, and the whole thing is like 400 milliseconds. But the things Van Hatran showed in here is if you flip right and left in a time, it's exactly the same. All of these moving bars,
right,
are.
Yes, exactly I understand.
The of the
yes, yes.
So in well, this sense, they are not.
No, I mean, look, I know that this stuff is wrong, okay? There's 100 reasons why this stuff is wrong, and I'm going to come on to that kind of stuff later in the talk, some of my reasons for thinking it's wrong. I mean, this is just what we've got, you know, so far. And there's lots of reasons why it doesn't fit the data. But I did want to make that point because yesterday we had a debate about the spatial frequency thing. So now we've got resolved that, we move on to some other reasons why it's wrong. I mean, it's wrong because we're treating the whole brain as a matrix that takes pixels in and multiplies them by the matrix. That's not what the brain is, right? So it's obviously wrong.
Well, there's also the underlying principle is independent components. You're assigning specific jobs to each element. Okay, so
yes.
They're isolated.
Yes, yes.
Versus the idea that
in the brain there
may do multiple things.
Yes. Okay. Well, I mean, I have a lot of material to get through. I haven't put the title slide up yet. No, I don't know if you want to see the rest of the talk. If anybody, I mean, I'd like you to edit your comments because there's hundreds of things you could say about this. You know, don't put up your hand every time.
Objective way of saying how well are you doing or how badly are you, like, reconstruct the movie.
Well, this is a complete mapping, so there's perfect reconstruction. So, you know, we win in that anyway.
Why are you saying strong? It's actually...
Well, I'll tell you in the rest of the talk if you be quiet.
Okay, so this was really just to motivate the talk. I didn't want the discussion to immediately. So if you look at these things beside each other, you can see how it is that, you know, they're kind of like, the filters are kind of like spatially differentiated versions of the basis functions. So there is some similarity between this and what happens in V1. I don't think anybody else has produced a better similarity than this. So this is the best that we've got so far, even though it's completely useless compared to what we need. But the rest of the talk is about, you know, what it is we actually need. So another picture that this is done with static images, and it's similar to what Ben showed yesterday, except that these filters are ordered. So here we put in like 16 by 16 patches, and we've ordered the filters topologically in a two-dimensional grid according to... So first of all, okay, these filters when you pass them over the image, or these basis functions, are supposed to come from independent sources. But these sources may not be independent. We can make them decorrelated easily, you know. But the higher order correlations, there could still be higher order correlations left there. And these ones are sorted in a two-dimensional grid by the degree of residual higher order correlation, right? And there's a it's not that complicated, but there's a technique for doing that, for basically training. You put in, instead of doing ICA, you put in like a prior that says, give me out guys that are, you know, or have a residual higher order correlation of a particular kind with their neighbors in like a 3x3 or 4x4 neighborhood. And it's a bit like Kahonen's topographic map, except with sort of ICA stuck in the bottom of it. And what you get is what are called pinwheels, which are singularities in the 2D map. Here, a high-frequency singularity and a low-frequency singularity. And if you go round and round these things, you pass through the pi, the 180 degrees of the orientation map. So this is exactly, you know, qualitatively what we get in V1. So you get these vortices, and you could even maybe from, you know, calculate, and nobody's actually done this, but you make a prediction from natural image statistics, take the images in, we bang them in, put them through this network, and make a prediction of how big the mini column, the cortical mini column, should be in V1. The mini column is kind of like, you know, something related to the distance from between here and here. It's like a sort of symmetry breaking in a 2D lattice that you get from having to put, you know, four parameters. The spatial X and Y spatial location, the orientation, and the spatial frequency. Those are the four parameters, and the phase, actually. The five parameters that determine these filters are pushed into a two-dimensional grid, and therefore we need to perform a symmetry breaking to get five parameters into two parameters, and that's why we get these singularities. A lot of people have worked on things like that. But the third thing I'd like to show you, which would be a surprise to you, I think, is spike timing dependent plasticity. This is a complete jump, right? What they've discovered, the modern version of Hebbian learning, is that when the presynaptic thing fires just before the postsynaptic thing, you get potentiation. The weight goes up on the hull, and if the presynaptic fires just after the postsynaptic, you get depression. So whether the weight goes up or down at a synapse in the brain depends on the timing of the spikes. This is, Misha's worked on this, a lot of people have worked on this. Henry Markram, Muming Pu, those are the labs that have produced some of the most publicized results. Now, in work that I've been doing recently with Lucas Parra, we've been able to show that if you take the natural grid, if instead of the inputs to your network being neurons' rates, which is kind of what we're assuming in the ICA model, if the inputs are timings of spikes, and if you do exactly the same mathematics that we did in ICA or in InfoMax on how timings of spikes affect each other, and then you calculate the gradient of the information transfer between some spikes over here and some spikes over here, and you calculate that gradient, and then you multiply it by a thing called the natural gradient, which is, instead of following the gradient directly, we follow the gradient in a sort of in a metric in a sort of not in a non-Euclidean space, but in a space that's governed by a Riemannian metric, which is the inverse of the Fisher information matrix, right? That's a mouthful. But there's a better way of talking about it even than the way that Amari talks about it. If you take the gradient of how some spikes affect some other spikes, and then you multiply that with this natural gradient transform, you actually get something very similar to the spike time independent plasticity. So I think this idea has application not just in rate models, but also in spiking models. And if I get time, I'll go through the whole. If I get time, the last few slides are on that. I just wanted to mention that the same idea can be used for a totally different setting.
I was wondering, I mean, you showed those the board filters. Is it
yes.
possible to set some kind of surrogate natural images which could produce the board filters?
Yes.
Like
yes. Yeah, if you want to get point light filters, you put in white noise, and then the independent variables are points, right? Mm-hmm. Every pixel is independent, and you just learn identity transform. Yeah, people cook up all kinds of weird image ensembles to find out what the independent components are. Okay. The fact that they're Gabor functions comes out of statistics of the natural images, which is one of the interesting things about it, actually, because it means you don't need genetics to train your brain, you just need experience, right? And then we're on the nature nurture debate.
Can you comment then on like
retina versus V1?
Yes,
in retina, the receptive fields are center surround, on and off, and that's the solution. Ben showed a picture like that yesterday. That's actually something like the solution you say. If you say I want to decorrelate, right? Let's say you want to do independence. You might do decorrelation first, and then try to deal with the higher order statistics afterwards. So if you say, I want to decorrelate, and I want the decorrelation matrix to be symmetrical, then you get a series of center surround filters. And that's actually a very good starting point from which to remove the higher order correlations. This is an empirical result. Like training times, if you put it through center surround filters based on decorrelating with a symmetric matrix, which is different from principal component analysis. Principal component analysis is decorrelating with an orthogonal matrix, not a symmetrical matrix. And it's actually a very bad starting point from which you could pre-transform your stuff by principal component analysis. It's like doing a Fourier transform. And that gives you it'd take you like 4 hours to train to get rid of the higher order correlations when you start from a principal component decorrelated solution. And it might only take you like 1 hour if you started from the center surround retina symmetric matrix decorrelation. That's a long answer, but. Okay, the rest of the talk is, on slides, and we can turn this off.
Twice.
Yes. Wow, there's an immediate difference in the quality of the visual display. So this was the title of the talk. What, if anything, is the objective function of the brain? And I think that's what, if you had to turn understanding the brain from a topic into a question, this is the question that I would turn it into. Not everybody would turn it into that question. Somebody would say, what is the cortical, what is the generic cortical microcircuit doing? And somebody else might say, what is the cortical thalamic loop? But for me, somewhere in the border between machine learning and neuroscience, I think it's really a question of finding learning algorithms, because there's a lot of stuff in the prior, there's a lot of stuff in the genome, it picks out these certain kinds of communication networks, but really we know that we're learning all the time and stuff is rewiring all the time. And the more people do neuroscience, the more they realize that, the membrane of cells is recycled, every day. And all the proteins are broken down and built up again, and the whole thing is stable over time, not necessarily because the genome said, I want to have this protein here, and this protein here, and this axon here, and this synapse here, but because it stays that way because there's a robustness and a stationarity in the statistics of your experience, right? And if you go to a foreign country, your synapses start rewiring like crazy. I think that's what happens, and you have to eat more, Just like in the energy constraint stuff that Ben was talking about. So I think this is the question. And that's what we're trying to do up at the Redwood Neuroscience Institute, some of us anyway. We have a debate about it. Not everybody thinks the same way. And I'm working with Lucas Parra and Nihat A on this kind of stuff. Lucas and I are working on the spike timing stuff. So the summary of the talk, this is when I'm still at the beginning of the talk, so I'm going to give you the summary. Simple cells, which is what I was showing you, complex cells, which are like those things, but they're nonlinear. They're like orientation selective cells, which are insensitive to the phase. So simple cells, complex cells, I haven't showed you why complex cells are our prediction of this model, but and I probably won't have time to, but there's papers on that. So simple cells, complex cells, color cells, in particular red-green opponency cells. If you put in hyperspectral, take images of the hyperspectral camera and put them into ICA, you get lots and lots of red-green opponent cells, and that's the main kind of opponency that you get in the visual system, in these cytochrome oxidase blobs, which actually occur, these color cells occur at these singularities on this 2D map that I showed you. Then these motion cells that I showed you from the Van Hatteren movie, the spatial layout of V1 that I showed you in that 2D grid, and spike time independent plasticity, right? These are all retrodictions of feedforward infimax under certain models. And what I mean by retrodiction is it's if you can't do a prediction in science, then you better do a retrodiction, right? At least explain the thing that you've already seen. And if you do that successfully, then maybe you can get on to explaining things that you haven't seen, like what the people did in particle physics when they did the standard model. But first they had to explain what they had seen, and then that's as far as we've got. So these are all things that explain, to some extent, qualitatively with caveats and reservations, the things that we have seen. The second part of the talk is...
Sorry, I'm embarrassed to ask, what's InfoMax? I'm sorry.
So when people say ICA, InfoMax it's a name that I gave to an algorithm that does independent component analysis, but it's actually slightly more general. It's an algorithm that maximizes the information transfer between one vector and another vector, it's a deterministic nonlinear transformation, which is invertible. And if you maximize the mutual information between the input and the output, you get, and this is what I'm going to explain it actually. You got a gradient descent algorithm called InfoMax, which under certain assumptions turns into independent component analysis. And that's what Ben was talking about. And that's the algorithm that's produced most of these results. So the second part of the talk is feedforward InfoMax cannot be the objective function of the brain. So I agree with everybody who wants to criticize it. And I'm going to give you specific reasons why it can't be that. I believe, however, that there is another candidate for the objective function of the brain. I'm going to propose it. But really very little has been worked out about it. But I'm going to try to motivate it and propose it.
That's maybe a hardly ignorant question then.
Right.
What is the objective function of the brain referred to?
The way I look at it like this. You have a function that you want to optimize, and you have some initial condition, right? Now, the initial condition is kind of like the genome, you know, or the thing which gives you the stuff that you're going to be learning with, right? But once you have that initial condition, which gives you spiking nets and stuff like that, the idea is that you're optimizing the connections between the neurons according to the gradient of some function. And yesterday we were talking about the gradient of function, which was reconstruction error minus, with some penalty cost on the number of weights and the amount of activity. And here we're talking about, another objective function, which in this case is the mutual information transfer between A and B. The whole talk, this whole thing is like, the objective function is try to get as much information from A to B, and we're gonna play with the stuff in between A and B to get as much information from A to B. That's what the whole thing is about.
Well, is that a trivial solution, which you don't do anything to
lose information?
Yes, but that's.
But, the
yes, of course. I've heard but the answer to this, right? this is a transformation which has a finite capacity, right? And therefore, basically, it says that each of the outputs can only be between 0 and 1, so you better use your range between 0 and 1 as much as possible, which means that, which leads to not doing the identity transform, because that wouldn't have the same.
It's not included in the principle. You're trying to sell us a single principle of optimization.
No, 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 no. There's two things. There's two things. There's the constraint. Well, that's, you know, these things are on the future slides. You know, you're asking questions about things I haven't explained yet.
So can I ask a question?
This is the summary.
What do you mean by the brain? Do you mean the sensory part of the brain, or?
I'd like it to be a theory of the whole brain, actually, because I think splitting the.
So you're not just dealing with sensory processing.
Well, I mean.
One issue is sensory processing; the other is to act on it.
Right. Yeah, but I don't sit around doing sensory processing and then I do some action, right? I think the loop is very, very intimate. And in cortex, there's a loop between V1, you know, information comes in, retina, thalamus, V1, there's a motor output from V1, right? You can have your eye movements based on the outputs of these little Gabor functions, right? So the motor loops are very tight. And you go to simpler organisms like cell creatures that don't have, where did sensory action come from? You know, one-celled animals which have a chemical network, there's a transduction between their receptors and their flagella and their cilia, right? You know, they're the sensory motor. I think that sensory motor loops are the primitives in the brain. They're not, it's not like we, you know, I think this whole, it's Western homuncular thinking, basically. You know, it's like, you know, we're gonna have lots of satellites circling the globe, gather all the information, put it in the Pentagon, and then the homunculus, whoever that is gonna make a decision about what to do based on the information. It's the wrong model. It needs to be tight sensory motor loops,
sure,
at all scales.
Human sensory yours.
You know, and even in statistics, they separate the estimation theoretic part of from the utility function, and I think that's wrong. I think utility and the estimation has to be linked intrinsically to the thing that you're trying to do. And we don't have a theory of that. You can't. But this Informax theory is not a theory of the brain for precisely this reason, because it's a feed-forward sensory theory, and we need to jump to a sensory motor theory. But this is the rest of the talk. You know, hold your questions. Everything will become slightly less obscure. Okay, that's the summary talk, the summary slide. Unless, you know, and please do ask questions if
they allow.
So, well, no, just do whatever you want, but I'll reserve the right to not answer. So here's, this is the algorithm. This, one of the questions was, what is this, right? Right. input X, matrix W, output Y. We put it through a sigmoidal function, a function that's bounded between 0 and 1. We call it G, right? G is an invertible function. We're going to change the weights according to the gradient of the mutual information between Y and X, the gradient with respect to the weights. So we're going to do that, right? We're going to put in an input. We're going to change this proportionally to this thing, right? So we split that mutual information up into its two parts, the entropy of the output and the conditional entropy of the output given the input. Now, if it's a deterministic transformation, then the condition, the uncertainty about the output given the input is non-existent, so that term drops away immediately. What? No continuous variables, right? They're continuous variables. Yes, they're continuous variables. What? We're going to take the differential entropy from Coburn. It's weird, you know. In the differential entropy, a differential entropy is minus infinity in a deterministic transformation, which is already strange. But that's what happens when you generalize information theory. Yes, that's the next, Ilya, look at the next line, right? If something's deterministic, then no matter what you do, you're not going to change the uncertainty when you change the mapping, as long as the mapping stays deterministic, because it'll stay, the conditional entropy will stay at minus infinity, no matter what you do. So then all you're doing then in the deterministic thing is maximizing the entropy of the output, right? You're looking, you've gone. So that term drops out, trust me.
Mutual information is parametrization invariant. If you've thrown away the second term, you'll have the entropy, which is not parametrization invariant.
Yes. Well, it might be something to do with. Right. No, I see what you mean there. But it might be. Well, we're taking gradients, right?
And the assumption that you can throw it with the continuous variable is not I think it's actually wrong. With the split variables, everything is fine.
But we're talking about the gradient. We're not talking about the actual. Obviously. Right, right,
so
right.
You can have one series of the quantization and discretization, x space and y space, and
first.
Still take a gradient with the W, which I think would make you happy.
This is a, you know, maybe we, you know, maybe we can go through this afterwards. It's always a little confusing, but this has really worked well so far. So so here we have the entropy, and we're differentiating with respect to the parameters. Then it splits up into two things, right? We have a relationship between output vector and an input vector when the transformation is invertible, and that relationship is just that the output probability distribution is the input probability distribution divided by the Jacobian matrix of the transformation, the absolute value of the determinant of the Jacobian matrix of the transformation. So when we plug that into here, expected log py, we get two terms. One is the entropy of x, which comes from this term. Another is the expected log Jacobian, which comes from this term. Now, if you're not doing anything and you never, you know, when I change my weights, it doesn't do anything, doesn't change anything in my input distribution, then that term drops out. That's why I say if you're passive, if you're a sensory system and nothing you ever do affects your input distribution. And the only thing you're left with is differentiating the log Jacobian. And the whole of this body of work is based on differentiating these log Jacobians for deterministic invertible mappings. If you do that, it's a little bit of tricky math, but when I first did it, I did it in Mathematica and rearranged the terms. It took me several days. But you get a learning rule like that. We change the weights according to a proportional to, this is the whole weight matrix. We have a term in the inverse transpose of the weight matrix, and then we have an outer product between the input vector and a nonlinear transformation of the linear part, the linear output vector. So intuitively, because you know, no matter how good people are at math, it's hard to push a body of theory through in one slide. Intuitively, what we're doing in a one-to-one mapping is we're making a sigmoid function if we have an input distribution like this, we're trying to make a neuron which has an activation function where the slopiest part is sitting on the peak of the sigmoid, and that the slope of this sigmoid function matches the variance of the thing. And if there's a total match in the sense that this function is the integral of this function, in other words, this is actually the cumulative distribution function of the input, then we map into an output into a uniform distribution in the 0-1 interval. And for a 0-1 bounded variable, the uniform distribution is maximum entropy. So that's intuitive, right? When we generalize this to n dimensions, it's kind of like we're firing input vectors in and we're putting them through this matrix and then the sigmoid functions. It's like we're firing the vectors into an n-dimensional hypercube, and we're trying to get all these dots to be uniformly distributed in the hypercube. So we want the output distribution to go to 1, right? And if we get that, then we also know that we've made each of the outputs independent of each other. That is, that the multi-information of the output vector, the generalization of each information, or the dependency or the redundancy in the output is going to go to 0. And if we do that, we will have achieved the goal of independent component analysis, because that is just to produce independent outputs. So that's a quick blast through, you know, the 95 paper. What happened after that was that, did anybody have any questions about that? Because that was actually quick, and that's the main technical slide of the whole thing. What happened after that was that, you know, that learning rule had an inverse transpose in it, which is a nasty thing. You don't really want to be updating your weight locally based on an inverse transpose of the whole weight matrix, right? That would be a really, that information isn't very available actually. So what happened, what Amari and Chachotsky and Yang did was to propose the natural gradient, which is a transform, a linear transform of this learning rule. So we're going to put twiddle above it and call it the new learning rule is going to be the old learning rule multiplied by W transpose W. So he hit on this because it simplified the learning rule a lot, right? If we multiply the old learning rule by W transpose W, then this W transpose, inverse transpose cancels. This W transpose X transpose turns into U transpose. That's just the output transpose. And we get a learning rule like this, which is much simpler and much more intuitive, right? The reason that it's justified to do this is that W transpose W is a positive definite matrix, which means that it has only positive real eigenvalues, which means that we're not going to be changing the position or sign of any of the minima of the algorithm. All we're going to be doing is changing the shape of the landscape. You know, ellipses will turn into bowls and things like that.
So in particular, assume that U and X have the same initial
value? Yes. Everything, in fact, part of the rest of the talk is to say that it only works for that case. And what do we do then? Because how can it be a theory of the brain if we can only do square matrices? And I think I have a proposal for that. But everything is square. Everything is a square mapping. We're not doing the overcomplete stuff like Ben did yesterday. So you can see that this learning rule is something like a nonlinear decorrelation, right? It's going to be stable. In other words, the weights are going to stop changing on average whenever this outer product is the average of this outer product is the identity matrix, right? So this is kind of like a nonlinear decorrelation. If F was linear, we'd be saying I is equal to UU transpose, and that would be decorrelation, right? Instead of which, we have a sort of nonlinear decorrelation. That's what enables us to get rid of the higher order statistics, the Taylor series expansion of this odd function F. And the exact value of this function depends on the shape of the sigmoid function that we put the thing through. There's a lot of technical points that's hard to, you know, it's hard to say everything about this whole body of work. There's answers to nearly all the questions, if you have them. But that's the rule that we've been using for ICA, and lots of people have been using it. And so this natural gradient transform was a very nice thing. We don't have to invert the matrix anymore. And what it did was actually increased the speed of convergence massively. And Amari was able to prove that this was because, you know, we're basically taking ellipses and turning them into bowls. Where his argument was that instead of doing gradient descent in the weight matrix space where the weights are, you know, where there's a Euclidean metric for the elements of the weight matrix, we have a Riemannian metric with a tensor, which is given by the inverse of the Fisher information matrix. But there's another theoretical explanation for that, which is to do with covariant versus contravariant. I don't completely understand all these things, but it's basically this is the right thing to do. You know, there are solid theoretical reasons for multiplying the learning rule by this, either thinking in terms of the metric space of this thing, or thinking in terms of making the convergence invariant. So anyway, yeah, I have to push on. It's numerically more efficient. It's more clearly a nonlinear decorrelation method, and it converges at the same rate regardless of the conditioning of W, right? So you could start off with some variables in the world that are mixed together with an almost singular matrix, right? And if you ran the original rule on them, it would take forever to converge because you have to invert an almost singular matrix, so you have to get like really big weights. If you're doing this natural gradient transform of the thing, it converges just as fast as if the matrix was an orthonormal matrix, right? So it has a lot of really nice properties. So this is what we use for all our source separation things.
Something particularly, you preserve all the information.
What's that?
You don't lose any information.
No.
It's a one-to-one menu.
Yes. It is funny. It is funny to optimize the information transfer when there's no information loss. But nonetheless, yes.
You are optimizing
only the Jacobian matrix.
Only the Jacobian?
The information is talking about the integral for log of a delta function. It's actually infinite information which you can use. And if you put discrete
phase of sex that not really know what's.
It's strange. It is strange, but it's worth thinking about. You know, when you do continuous entropies, you know, funny things happen like that. I think that's kind of what I concluded eventually.
Why don't you say just maximize the output?
Yeah, okay, we can do that. Okay. The reason is that, you know, if it's a noisy system, we don't want to maximize the output entropy because we can have noise entropy there.
But you apply it to deterministic.
It's deterministic, so in that case, they're the same.
That's back to the original problem. You can maximize the output entropy. First, you cannot maximize infinity. You can do it by picking a strange nonlinear transformation, and then.
So there's three cases we can consider. One is the square case, the complete case. Another is the overcomplete case. Another is the undercomplete case. Now, straight away in the overcomplete case, you can see that if you know you mix some hidden variables together into some lower dimensional space, you're not going to get them out again, right? You can't do that. You can't invert a non-square matrix. So these guys out here, no matter what they're going to be, are not going to be independent anymore. So we're actually in a different game when we're doing an overcomplete mapping than when we're doing the complete one. And in fact, our ICA density model that works so nicely for the square case doesn't work because we can't differentiate a log Jacobian anymore because we don't have a square matrix. In other words, the Jacobian matrix is not square, and so we can't have a nice relationship between the input density and the output density. even though Schricke and Sompolinski and Lee published a paper claiming some things in this, I think it's actually not right. What's that?
They are using a pseudo inverse instead of your inverse.
But no, they weren't. They had that, and then they had some. They were doing it for overcomplete, and they were doing it through. Instead of taking the determinant of the Jacobian, they would take the square root of the determinant of the Jacobian transpose Jacobian, and I don't think it's right, actually. You know, if you shrink their equations down, you don't end up with independent variables here, and you can't end up with independent variables here. In fact, what the main person that worked on this was Max Welling, Jeff Hinton, and Simon Ossendero, and they tried to analyze the overcomplete case, and they basically found out that, you know, you end up with the partition function. You have to take the gradient of the log partition function. But I'm going to talk about that. That's what it's about. That's what the next part's about. So can we get from this simple little square matrix theory to a brain theory, right? Well, we know how to optimize this square ICA. But what do we do when this is the retina, this is the thalamus, this is V1, V2? We have feedback going in both directions, and all these the representations at each level are different sizes, right? Which is makes an overcomplete or undercomplete mapping.
Well, since now we've found the brain theory, the question is, I mean, taking derivative of log probabilities is always problematic, especially when the probability itself, the distribution is something, you know, discontinuous. Then how can you ever? It's going to be, I mean, log probabilities. Being able to take a derivative of log probability is much harder than taking derivative of probability.
Well, but we're doing it the expected log probability, which means that it's weighted by how much probability there is, right? So if you have zero probability, then you never see that, right? So we're talking always entropies which are expected log probabilities and expected log Jacobians. Yeah, I think that's the answer. So yeah, so problem one is that for the overcomplete and undercomplete cases, like I said, this relationship doesn't hold, which means that. And this relationship is what ensures that as the entropy of Y is maximized, the probability distribution of Y and the output converges on the unit distribution, and therefore absolute value of the determinant of the Jacobian matrix is actually an estimator for the input density. So this is really a density estimation algorithm, and some people just like to call it a maximum likelihood algorithm, where the likelihood function is the determinant of the Jacobian. So the log likelihood is the log determinant of the Jacobian. But when the thing is non-square, when the number of outputs is not equal to the number of inputs, it's not true, and so no such simple density model exists. The second thing is that when we have more complicated dependencies, for example, if we want to make, well, I don't really want to go there. So this is just to say that I don't want to talk about that. I want to talk about what I tried to do for several years, which is to make an algorithm called dependent component analysis, right? So instead of making the outputs independent of each other, we try to make them, we try to map them into a space where they have certain dependencies between each other, because there are dependencies between neurons and the brain, so therefore, this is something that we probably want to do, right? Then the first step in this dependent component analysis was taken by Hevarinen and Hoyer, and they did a thing called subspace ICA. And they made the, so in subspace ICA, the dependencies between neurons are modeled in this function here, which is the score function. So before we just had this function coming from, we have the ith value of the score function. The general case is that the ith value of the score function should be the derivative with respect to ui of the log probability of the model of the data, of log probability of the output vector. And in the ICA case, this probability split up into a factorial distribution, right? This p hat of all these u's was split up into a product of the outputs, of the product of the estimated densities of the individual outputs. In the general case, though, we don't have to assume this factorial thing. This probability model could be anything. You know, it could be a correlated Gaussian, it could be whatever, right? And we have a general rule where what we put in here, the elements we put in here for this vector are exactly the derivatives of the general probability model that we're using. So this is what we call dependent component analysis, because this probability function could be anything. So the first application of the idea was to split up the output density into a product of subspaces instead of a product of univariate distributions, so a product of distributions on subspaces. And so if you did that, this is what I notate with like small j. It's kind of like this. So before we would have say like four output units which are supposed to be independent, and now we're going to have two groups of two output units each, which are supposed to be dependent and dependent in a certain way. So when we put the images through ICA and calculated the joint distributions of the outputs, the main thing we found was that if the outputs had like Laplacian distributions, you took the product of Laplacians, you get this diamond shape that we saw yesterday, right? But the most common form of residual dependency that was left in the statistics of the outputs was that they would still be marginally Laplacian, but they would be radially symmetric, right? And what this was used by Hevarinen to make complex cells. So here we have a group of two cells, one doing the sine part, you know, another doing the cosine part of some Gabor functions. So it would look like this. You know, like phase shifted by 90 degrees with respect to each other, so that when you took the length of their activity, right? So a complex cell is a cell that would output some sensitivity to this orientation, but would be invariant to the phase. So it would be like a cell that's calculating, you know, we pass one filter over, we take the dot product between one of our cells and the input, dot product between the other cell and the input, we square the two, add them and take the square root, so that we're getting the length of the activity of these two cells. So the length of that length is exactly corresponding to doing a polar transform from the activity of the cells in Cartesian coordinates to like the activity of the cells in polar coordinates, so that this length of the vector is the activity of the complex cell. So this was proposed as a model to explain the self-organization of these complex cells. And actually, this form of dependency is the same form of dependency that we have in organizing this two-dimensional topographic map that I showed you at the beginning. Like, cells that were next to each other are supposed to have this sort of radially symmetric dependency with each other. And if you actually look at them, you'll very often find Gabor pairs sitting beside each other on that map. So this was the first kind of indication that we could do something beyond ICA. We could learn these independent subspaces, and the length, we take the image vector and we project it into the independent subspace and measure the length of that vector, and that would be something that would have a radially symmetric distribution in that subspace, and the length of that thing would be like the activity of a complex cell. So this was the first indication that we could learn something beyond simple cells. So then it was kind of exciting because we thought, well, we'd learn simple cells using linear thing, we can use complex cells using this polar transform, which is, then we can just iterate the nonlinearity and learn the rest of the brain, you know, one vector after another, right? That was kind of like the image that we had at that time. And some people still do believe that. I don't believe that anymore. And the reason is as follows, right? When you're doing a so this is all graphical models, Bayesian networks, right? This is a Bayesian network where the four nodes are independent, right? So this is a probability model of the data where your outputs are independent variables. This is a probability model where they're dependent in this radial sense with each other, but the independent subspaces, the subspaces are independent. In other words, the whole density is given by the product in this the density in this subspace times the product of the density in this subspace. And we could also imagine trees, right? So the main result in Bayesian networks, one of the main results in graphical models, is that everything works for trees or factorized distributions. So that we can write, for example, the density of these three variables as a product of these this marginal density and this marginal density, and then we've got to take out the marginal density that we counted twice, right? So we divide by it, right? So that works fine for a tree like this, but we put one more thing in here, and Ilya remembers this because we went through it at NIPS together a couple of years ago. You put in one more link into this dependency graph, and you suddenly have a probability model that doesn't normalize. So if you do what's called inclusion-exclusion on these densities to get that, you know, the overall density should be P12 times P23 times P13, and then divide by the densities that we're counting twice, which is these three marginal densities, we get an estimate of the density which is not normalized. What's that?
The marginal subspaces have a node now, and no longer the P12, P23, P13, even if you normalize.
Right, that's true. Yes, it is worse. So, we could make it so that they're consistent with each other, in which case it would be fine, right? I mean, you know, let's say that we know these marginals exactly, right, as opposed to having estimates. Then they're going to be consistent with each other, and then this formula.
But then the marginals of the hat are not going to be the same. So if I integrate the third variable out of P1 to 3, you will not get P1 to 3.
No, that's true, yes. So that's true, but already we're in trouble because we've got 1 over z, right? And everybody in physics knows about 1 over z. It's all through everything, quantum field theory, even. If I go and look at Tony Z's book, I see, you know, the same term there, and this equation you see everywhere. So. So Jeff Hinton is looking at trying to deal with these unnormalized models, and he calls them energy-based models. So all the probabilities are 1 over the partition function, 1 over this normalizer, times the exponential of the energy. Now, in the Boltzmann machine, we know from way back that that when we differentiate this log probability, we get a term in the energy, and we get a term in Z. And those terms are very similar to each other. In fact, they're the same term, except they have a minus sign. The derivative of the energy is the same as the derivative of the log of Z, except it has a minus sign, and except instead of being sampled over the data distribution in the energy case, it's sampled over the model distribution in the case of the partition function. So if you make a dependent component analysis model which has a complicated energy-based, you know, probability model, and we want to change the weights to maximize the log probability under a model like this, which has this normalizing function and it has some functions up here corresponding to our, you know, subspaces or shared subspaces and things like that, we get a nice little natural gradient ICA rule that looks like this, right? Which is just like it was before, but instead of sampling, instead of just having this term here where we're sampling over the data distribution, we've got a negative of this term sampled over the model distribution. So how do we do that, sampling over the model distribution? That's like, that. How would you possibly know the, how would you possibly know, you know, what, you can't sample over the model distribution, basically. So it would be like, it would be kind of like if you want to change one weight in your brain, you'd have to know how that changes the log probability of how likely you think almost every other thing is. And that's a very hard integration to do, and it's the same problem that people find in statistical physics every time they're doing the 2D easing model or something like that, or any kind of statistical physics problem. They have to calculate the gradient. Well, they don't have to calculate the, usually in machine learning, our problem is to calculate the gradient of the partition function. In the physics, the problem is probably more to just write down what the thing is or try to find an analytic solution of it. So anyway, it's a complete mess, right? You can't really do this, you know? There are some ways of sampling that you could confabulate. You could look at a picture and then you could like dream up a whole bunch of random pictures, or you could look at a picture and then dream up some pictures that are related to those pictures and then use those as like training data for your negative phase of your Boltzmann machine or to calculate this term. But you can't, but you can, it's not really a practical way to do thinking, right? I mean, you can't be continually sampling from the model distribution while you're doing things. So I think this is a dead end, actually. I think that if we run into Z, we should give up and do something else, right? That's the main message of the talk. And I think what we should do is find a case where we have still have a square matrix, right? Now, how do we do that? How do we treat this information processing as being like a square matrix? Where when we have like all these different layers, matrices between different layers in the brain, and the whole thing is very complicated and hierarchical and things like that. I think what we have to do is to consider the matrix to be the transformation between the whole brain's state vector at one moment in time and its state vector in the next moment in time. Unless you're adding neurons, right? That transformation is going to be have a square Jacobian. So what we should do is we should stop thinking about feedforward Infomax, and we should do Infomax across time, because we still have a square matrix and all our mathematics works, and we don't have to calculate the gradient of the log partition function.
What so, be
what?
So you assume that the dynamics is linear?
No, I don't, because even in this case, the dynamics wasn't linear. Well, it doesn't have dynamics, but the mapping is non-linear, right? We had the sigmoid functions. We don't care if the Jacobian matrix is, you know, has a nonlinear dependency in where we are in the data, anything like that. That doesn't really matter. It doesn't even matter that the transformation is nonlinear. It really helps if the transformation is invertible. It really should be deterministic. Otherwise, we don't have a Jacobian matrix. We have a ratio of conditional distributions. What? Yes.
Trees over there, there's also, you know,
yes.
There's input.
Yes, I know.
So the mapping between now and the future is definitely not a deterministic transformation.
That's true. So,
and
so.
Of course, you're losing information unless you claim to remember.
Which first?
No, I mean, you're losing information in time unless you deny that you forget something.
Yes, you are. So it's not going to be in.
Information is going to preserve not only the information of the past, but also all the input accumulated.
Well, the conditional entropy going forward in time, if it's deterministic and if we don't have input, right? If the conditional entropy going forward in time is going to be it's going to be zero or minus infinity or whatever, it's going to be at its minimum. Backwards in time, it's going to be, you know, it's like a reversible system, right? It's an irreversible system, but it still can be deterministic in the forward time direction, which means we can still differentiate a log Jacobian in the forward time direction. Now the case that you're talking about, where we have inputs, if you didn't have input and you never did anything, the system would be Markovian and there'd be no statistics.
Not necessarily.
Well.
For a large system, for a very large system, it's not going to be Markovian, even if you do step by step approach.
Why?
The fixes the, basically, not talking about the one-dimensional system anymore. For a very large.
Well, just have a big state vector and another big state.
Precision.
But didn't you incorporate inputs?
There are quite traditional system-dimensionalizing models. They are not in one dimension. But the two-dimensional system is not more good.
Yeah,
well, if I have some deterministic nonlinear differential equations that are just marching forward in time without input, surely that system is Markovian.
If you have many of them, that's
fine. If I have many of them, it's globally Markovian. I don't mean locally Markovian. Yeah, well, I just have a transformation from 10 billion to 10 billion, and it's. Until I do 10 billion.
It's an infinite space, state space. So you have an infinite dimensional system, and the evolution is not necessarily more prevalent.
Huh.
If you have a differential equation, you can always consider the Markov.
Exactly. I mean, I'm thinking ergodicity, but that's not what he's talking about. He's just saying, can you map it to D plus 1?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
That's
yeah.
What he's saying.
Yeah.
Look at spin chain. Long spin chain, right? And you're evolving through transfer matrix, long spin chain in second dimension. The evolution between first layer and the second layer, right? Since there are infinitely many ways you can talk from here to here, directly to the second channel, to the third channel, you may have space transitions in the system. You may have a divergent correlation length in time in the system. Our Markovian system always has a finite correlation length. And here you can't have an infinite correlation.
Can we kill the light again?
Smaller than the
can we kill the light?
Very large correlation.
That's a technical point.
Yeah, it's a technical point.
I'm talking about a finite system with finite precision. That's why I have to lose information.
Actually, if you want a system that is contracting, it's not, you would only maximize, but it would still be a loss.
Okay. So this is, so I've already said the things that are on this slide. There are three cases to consider, one where we have no input, another where we have input but we don't do anything, in other words, nothing, no activity of our brain ever affects the probability distribution of the input, and the third case is when we have input and we're doing something, right? Now, in the case where we're doing feedforward infimax, we could never really deal with this case, right? Because in feedforward infimax, you're trying to estimate the density of the input, and if your estimation of the density of the input in itself affects the density of the input, then you can't estimate it. It's like, the thing is moving when you're estimating it, So we could never deal with this case in the feedforward infimax case. But at least conceptually, I believe that in the temporal infimax case, this might become simpler, right? Because what you really have is you're back to a square Jacobian. All intra-brain feedback and hierarchy is flattened into W, the brain's weight matrix. And the external world can be treated as a source of mutual information across time, right? And that kind of makes sense in a kind of intuitive cognitive sense. I mean, we couple up to things in the world that have diversity and temporal coherence. We don't watch white noise on TV. That's a lot of entropy, but there's no mutual information across time, so we don't watch white noise on TV. Similarly, we don't watch things that have a lot of regularity, but which are have low entropy. We don't listen to sine waves. We like things that are rich information transforming itself across time. That's the thing. We talk to other people, right? They're high sources of entropy and coherence across time. Even in our lives, if you think back, back to yourself as a child, you're in some sense the same person as you are when you grow up. You've been through a lot of transformations, but you're a very different vector now than you were then, but there's a lot of mutual information between that thing that you are now and that thing back then. So I think there's something in biology that wants to create this strong mutual information flow across time thing. And even culturally, when we build libraries and even genetically, when we transfer information through a molecular bottleneck, like, what is the purpose of life, right? If you ask people what is the purpose of life, they'll say, depending on their orientation, they will say something like, well, the purpose of life is to have pleasure, or they will say the purpose of life is to have children, right? But you know, if you're not having children, but you're spending a lot of time in the library instead, then maybe your purpose is to write books, you know? All of these things are, you know, to contribute to the mimetic flow rather than genetic flow. All of these things are like flows of information across time, you know? You know, you could be doing it molecularly or mimetically or whatever. So I think there's, I really think there's something here, you know? There's some sense in which, what?
So, no, I mean, I don't believe that, like, when you talk to people, you are interested in learning the maximum amount of information from them. Tell everybody who teaches students know that.
No, I didn't. That's not what I said. But that is, what, don't disagree with something that I didn't say. Well, now, yeah. I'm talking to you right now, and what we're doing is creating a joint mutual information across time process through our dialogue.
No, it may be that
you've got to take the joint state space.
Some things which I want to forget, right?
There may be things that you want to forget.
My function is to forget some things which are irrelevant to me. That's one thing.
But can't you always, this goes back to the conversation we were having earlier about if you want to preserve all information, why don't you just do an identity map? So as in any other principle, there will be constraints.
Right.
The constraints could be simply capacity. The constraints could be based on the idea that there is information that you don't want to preserve. So you want to preserve quote-unquote relevant information. How are you going to sort it out? So the idea is that you want to maximize the information transmission, not necessarily to make it to preserve all the information. Otherwise, you're back to the notion of an identity mapping. So the fact that you, what I'm trying to say is the fact that you want to give some constraints on the principle doesn't mean that the principle itself could not be the starting principle.
Exactly. That's actually exactly the conclusion I came to. It totally doesn't make sense to maximize mutual information across time without constraints, right? Because what you could say you were doing in Boolean automata, right? All you do is you cycle through the whole state space. You visit every possible state. You know, you do a counting automata. You just count up to from one to your final state, and you go back to the beginning, and you loop the whole thing. It's deterministic. Your mutual information across time is the entropy of the state vector, which is the log of the number of states you visit. And that's a really boring solution to mutual information across time, right? So, I mean, that would mean that we could just shut off our, what's that?
What is the mutual information across time?
The mutual information across time in that system is the log of the number of states. It's the mutual information across time. Well, then you've got to get into the canonical ensemble and things like that. It's the definition of, right.
It's a time t, it's a time t plus one, it's information. It's a time t and it's a time t plus one.
Yes, but you have. But you have to have an ensemble, right? So then the ensemble is defined by the temporal variable. Right.
I mean, I don't know if it makes sense or not, but that would be the definition.
Right. So in my mind, it's kind of something like, you know, every moment in time, you take the log Jacobian and you try to make it bigger. You go to the next moment. Look at the new log Jacobian of the transformation time, try to make it bigger, and you just run forward in time, making this log, try to make this log Jacobian bigger. But in the general case where you're coupled up to the world, I think we're talking about the log Jacobian of the joint system. Anyway, these are the things that we have to deal with, right? This is all these things, all these two columns here are could be in our model, could be deterministic transforms. The transformation between the sensory at time t to the brain at time t plus one is called perception, right? This means sensory, brain, and motor, right? So these two columns could be all deterministic things, could be dealt with log Jacobians. Perception, the sensory motor transformation is reflex, the brain to brain transformation is thinking, the brain to motor transformation is acting, the motor to brain transformation is proprioception, and the motor to motor transformation is like a motor program. And then you have this other stuff, this column here, which is a source of uncertainty. It's statistical. We're not talking Pratt-Jacobian transformations. We're talking about, it's not deterministic. It's not, you know, I'm changing the weight matrix of the brain. I'm changing only these guys. I can't change these. These are uncertain things. Like when I do something, I don't know what it's going to happen, right? I can try to learn that. I can try to reduce this conditional entropy. That's going to be part of the objective, but it's not, nonetheless, this is going to be a source of stochasticity. Also, like Elia said, the world contingency is going to be a source of stochasticity. And also, the world knowledge is a sort of, you know, the, well, whatever you would call the how likely the sensory, you know, the probability distribution of the sensory that I'm using the time based on my whole brain state, that's also going to be stochastic. Yes?
I would like to repeat my question from the beginning.
Yep.
Promised an answer.
Yes.
How do you actually use your framework now to do the middle goal within acting? Because acting is success.
I don't have an answer. Okay. I'm just trying to propose that mutual information across time with constraints could be a way to go, right? It has the right form. It has the right structure. And the reason is that think back again to the Boolean automaton, right? That would cycle through all its states. That's clearly a counter argument to what I'm saying. That's not the thing that we have in the brain. What we have in the brain is, you know, if we send the spikes around, they are they require energy to it requires energy to make these spikes, and if as a consequence of your spiking you don't get any food, then pretty quickly things are going to fall apart. In other words, you're going to have the system will not behave deterministically anymore. There'll be some other variables coming up from beneath that destroy the thing. You'll get low entropy solutions because the energetics doesn't work. So what I believe actually is that the brain is doing informatics across time with some kind of implicit energy constraint. It's not like an extra term in the equation. It kind of exists in the prior in some sense. It exists in the network. Like if you don't eat, then you're not going to have a spiking network anymore, which means you can't have the information flow across time, which means that you have to do things in order to actually preserve your model, as it were. Now I'm really at the edge of what it is that I'm able to say at this point. I'm trying to create like a negative space where the answer can flow into it. You know, it just seems to me that
I can get cookies without thinking is better.
You can get cookies without thinking.
I can get cookies without information maximization. Why should I maximize? The constraint can be much more important than
other things. You can maximize something else, which is your prediction or your future. You don't care about the past.
I do.
It goes back to things that Ilya and others have been
but,
doing.
Yeah, but I know, so you guys working on information bottleneck and the predictive information ideas and earlier ideas from Crutchfield that were kind of related. I think all those, I really think and the things I'm pushing here are related to this, and I think it's the only game. It's the only game in town, right? I don't see anybody else in the Santa Fe Institute producing, you know, like a better measure of complexity than something like the predictive information or the number of causal states, right? But we have to take that idea and turn it into a sensory motor idea.
What's the connection?
What's the connection?
Between
this?
Your information lossless evolution in some sense of life. Versus actually losing everything that you don't need for the future, which is entirely different.
Well, what you want to do in the predictive information framework is throw away all the information in the past that doesn't tell you anything about the future distribution. Now, you don't have a sensory motor theory. You have a way of talking about the sensory case only, where what you do doesn't affect the distribution. So you would want to throw away all information that doesn't tell you anything about the future. And symmetrically, you would want to throw away all the information about the future that doesn't tell you anything about the past.
No,
exactly. Even though you can't really do that, right?
But the
well, there's but if you split the entropy of the whole process into three terms, you get the mutual information between the past and the future, the conditional entropy between the past and the future, and the conditional entropy between the future and the past. So if you're maximizing, so that's actually the answer to your question. Where's the chalk? What did I do with it? Oh, here's some. Yeah, so if this is the whole process and you're here, you want in your state vector to hold this thing, right? The mutual information between the past and the future, and the entropy of the whole thing splits up into that and the two conditional entropies. So, in maximizing the, in trying to get well, in the Crutchfield term, in trying to get the causal states compiled into your current state vector, you're implicitly throwing away the irrelevant stuff in the past and the irrelevant stuff in the future, even though that kind of doesn't really make sense. But in the mutual information sense, it's completely symmetric. So does that answer the... Okay. Okay. And actually, you know, the cookies are about to happen, and I have three more slides which are on. I'd like to talk about these things while I'm here, because I think that really we should try to solve the whole problem, not solve the sensory problem, because it could be that when you're doing things that are creating the future, which is what we do all the time, you know, we create the future with our own actions, that the sensory motor problem, it could be simpler to solve than the sensory problem alone. You know, it's a little bit like, you know, how good a child would you be if you grew up just watching television, right, never doing anything? How much could you learn about objects? You know, you can learn much more about objects when you can do things. So I think that the sensory motor problem is intrinsically an easier problem for an organism to solve than some sensory only problem.
I don't want to stop people from getting cookies, but there are a lot of these terms that I don't understand. Can I just ask you for a quick definition?
Yes.
Maybe I'm just guessing what they mean.
Yes.
What does motor program and proprioception mean? What's motor program?
Well, you know, I drew this box. I like to make matrices of variables and put names in, right? So I just put proprioception is a common word. It means the information that's sent from your muscles to your brain,
okay,
so that your brain knows what you're doing,
okay,
right? And motor program, I imagine, I've got some motor neurons and they're connected to some other motor neurons. What am I going to call that weight matrix? I decided to call it motor program because it's kind of like a recurrent process within the motor, the action creating units.
Thanks.
So, what? You know, I could be shot by it for many things in this talk, by many different people. But I'm interested in trying to make some progress, and so I want to throw out some stuff that didn't really work out. I don't know if you want to hear a few minutes about spiking stuff. I don't want to hold anybody back if they need to have cookies, but I think that this is interesting. And it also, you know, I'd like to finish on a note that's not so hand-wavy because when, you know, just to convince you that I'm not just in the clouds. Can we kill the lights again? In Spike Informax, which Lucas and I are submitted to NIPS, which doesn't mean, of course, that it will be accepted, we have the following facts. Neurons knew spikes, not real numbers. And this whole ICA Informax receptor field stuff is kind of treating the firing rate as if it was a real number. There's increasing evidence that when we know what the neurons are talking about, in other words, when we're looking at sensory neurons that are close to the signals that they're dealing with, the spike timings are relevant. This is the work that, you know, Bill Bialik has really been pushing over the last 15 years or so. And, you know, a lot of demonstrations have shown that spike timings are relevant in these sensory neurons. So the third factor is that this modern experimentally observed Hebbian plasticity is timing dependent. And that's what I described at the beginning, that if this is the presynaptic neuron and it fires before the postsynaptic neuron by a time delta t, then if we plot, you know, how the weight changes as a function of delta t, we find that the weight between neurons goes up. If this one helped this one to fire, but if it came after and sort of didn't help it to fire, the weight goes down. And there's an exponential dependency, or possibly exponential dependency, of this weight change on the, so that when they're exactly synchronized, there is a transition, an abrupt transition between weight going down and a weight going up, between depression and potentiation. So this has been thought of as like trying to make causal networks. If this guy helped make this one happen, he will strengthen. So I really think this is it's a beautiful problem for theorists, and that's why there's five theories for every for you know, if you go to a workshop on it, there's loads and loads of theories and lots of conflicting data, and Ilya can tell you how frustrating, Misha could tell you how frustrating this area is, because nobody really knows. But you know, if we can see how this learning is information theoretically optimal or something, then perhaps we can understand spike coding and connect machine learning ideas with real neurons. And then, you know, NIPS would be a different kind of conference, right? And all the support vector machine people could think about, you know, point processes instead of, you know, binary vectors. And so here's the idea. Instead of making our log Jacobian, from how neuron I's rate affects neuron J's rate, it's the wrong way around, right? How J affects I, right? We're going to use how the timing of spike L affects the timing of spike K. So we're just changing the variables, and we're going to run all the same mathematics that we did before. And so there's a model called the spike response model by Wolfram Gerstner and other people, which says that when a spike comes along in the synapse, a neurotransmitter goes across here, and we get a thing called an excitatory postsynaptic potential, a little hump that happens here. And so it's kind of like putting the delta function through a linear filter at the synapse. And then there's another linear filter between the synapse and the soma called, you know, the capacitance of the membrane transfer. So by the time you get up here, you've basically put this little delta function through a function like this, which is the EPSP, right? It goes up and comes down slightly more slowly than it goes up. So this is what I draw here, right? So here it is, right? Now clearly, if I wiggle this spike back and forward, I'm going to change the timing of this spike, right? But it depends on whether I'm this side of the hump or that side of the hump. If I move the spike forward when I'm on this side, then it's going to, it's going to be maximum. The effect of this thing is going to be maximum on this thing when we're at the peak, right? Otherwise, it's going to be small. And we go on either side, when we're on this side and we move it forward, we're going to be getting more voltage than we were before, which means that the thing is going to reach threshold earlier, relatively earlier, and the opposite when we're on this side. And that's basically the origin, in this model anyway, of the transition, of this transition between potentiation and depression, is the change in the sign when you're going on either side of the top of the EPSP.
So that's fine if you only have one input.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So now you have multiple inputs to the same argument.
Yes, it's the next slide. It's exactly analogous to what we had in the ICA case, where we look at one input, one output, and then we go transform the whole thing to a whole matrix, and we end up with a Jacobian matrix. Except now we have a Jacobian matrix between all spike timings, right? And I don't just mean in one neuron, I mean in all neurons. All the spikes in all neurons are going to be turned into big vector T of timings, and we're going to look at the Jacobian matrix between all those timings and themselves, actually, ultimately, when we're doing the temporal infomax version of this that we're trying to do. Otherwise, you can think of it as a feed-forward network where there's some spikes down here, some spikes up here, and they're not the same neurons, they're not the same spikes, but we could have the Jacobian matrix between these input spikes and these output spikes. So if we do that, the key insight which Lucas had, actually, is, and he's going to be here on Monday, because we have to arrange things so that we can work together, because he's in New York, so I told him to come here and crash. So he's going to be crashing some of this stuff. But the key insight which Lucas had was that we have to use implicit differentiation. We have the neuron, when this variable U reaches threshold of 1, say, then we are going to output a spike, right? Now, value, that potential, is going to be a weighted sum over all the spikes which affect that voltage of the weight, of the synaptic weight, times this response function that we're talking about, this RKL thing. And that RKL thing depends on the timing dependency, depends on the two things. It depends on when the input spike happened and when the output spike happened. So the value we have here depends on the difference between these two times. So we can do implicit differentiation, which is related to like level sets and things like that, to kind of calculate the dependency of this on the dependency of that. Physicists do that kind of thing all the time. And if we do that, we get the dependency of the inputs of the output spike on the input spike, and we get exactly a term which goes like that. Now, if we then try to maximize the log Jacobian of that thing,
sorry, this assumes that there is no other intermediate spike that went through the network?
Well, here actually, the case we're considering in this little piece of mathematics here, before we get to the more complex case, this is a degenerate case, actually, because there's only one input spike and there's only one output spike. So actually, we're going to calculate a learning rule and then show that delta W is zero, right? It's only when we go to the end-to-end case that we get something which is meaningful. But it's good to do the one-to-one case to see the form of it, right? If we calculate the gradient of the mutual information between the timing of the input spike and the output spike when there's no other spikes in the network, right, we get a learning rule like this. We have a 1 over W term just as before, and we have a product, except it's a quotient, of an input variable and an output variable, except now, instead of the input variable being, you know, the X and the output variable being the firing rate of the neuron, input firing rate and output firing rate, the input variable is the time derivative of this of the response function, and the output variable is the time derivative of the voltage when you cross threshold. Now, if we do that for the end-to-end case, where we create a big Jacobian matrix T of timing dependencies, a big matrix which says, it's like we have like, you know, N disembodied spikes over here, another N disembodied spikes over here, and there's a matrix of influence between them. And that's what this Jacobian matrix is, the timing dependency matrix. And we take the derivative of the log determinant of that Jacobian matrix with respect to the weights, we get the following learning rule, which is analogous to ICA before we did the natural gradient, right? We have the same kind of thing. We have an inverse of the Jacobian matrix. We have various terms, basically. It's completely non-local and it's kind of a mess. But if we try to do the natural gradient of it, which is to put the thing through this transformation so that it has uniform performance and, you know, the Fisher information matrix and the inverse of the Hessian and all that kind of stuff, we get this rule. And by analogy, the inverse has disappeared. We get a term in the weight as before, and we get a slightly non-local term which involves the timing dependencies of, so if I'm looking at the dependency between spike L and spike K, right? How spike L is affecting, input spike L is affecting output spike K. What I have to, I have some non-local terms which are all the other spikes which are caused by the same input spike. So I have a spike coming up an axon, it goes to this neuron, goes to that neuron. And so how this spike affects, this spike is going to affect all these different neurons. And it's, if it produces a spike, this spike is going to affect the timing of these spikes in these other neurons. And this sum of TILs is the sum of the dependencies of those other output timings on this particular input thing. So it's almost local, but there's all kinds of non-local effects in strike time independent plasticity. People haven't even really, they don't agree about these things. You know, Mooming Poo told me that if you're looking at a big weight matrix and you look at one synapse, what you want to do is to what you actually find, if I try to create a weight change at one synapse, I also observe weight changes at other synapses coming from the same neuron and going, basically if the whole thing is a weight matrix, it's in the row and the column, right? So if you're looking at, if I'm looking at this synapse here, Wij, and I'm inducing a change in this weight, I'm also going to see changes in these weights and in these weights.
Because, is that because you can never have a spike by a single input? You're always going to have, a joint probability distribution that, in order to create a spike,
yes,
you always have to have other inputs at the same time, so you can't treat them as independent.
No, it's not because of that. I don't know why he observes this. This is just it's an experimental result that it's the same thing as what Bonhoeffer saw in the, it's a more precise version of what Bonhoeffer saw in this, in the non-specific spread of LTP kind of thing.
Okay. This is the more
Jenny.
This T matrix, Jacobian matrix you have here, you're,
yes,
assuming L to K and you're sort of having the time dependency, right? This L spike is causing the K spike.
Yes. And lots of other ones are as well.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
And if we assume this half of the matrix is from this direction to that direction, the other half then is reversed. How do we explain that? And what is this calculation?
Okay, so what is displayed here is a completely abstract case which doesn't really exist in the brain, where we imagine we have like some neurons down here that are spiking and some other neurons up here that are spiking in response to them, and it's like a feed-forward transformation of spiking dependency. But we don't have any sort of feedback in this case. What we have to do in the feedback case is analogous to what I was hinting at earlier, which is to turn the feed-forward theory across space into a information transfer across time theory. And if you do that, you actually end up with something rather complicated, which hasn't properly been worked out, involving dependencies which would have to propagate across time. So that's kind of based on the idea that, so we're considering this case, where we have some spikes down here, and we have some spikes up here. But what we really have, of course, is this vector here is all the spikes, and this vector here is all the spikes. So what are we really talking about? We're talking about something like this, where there's some initial condition, which is over here in the timing matrix, like the initial spikes, right? They're the spikes which are not caused by anything. They're initial boundary condition. These are the spikes over here at the end of the simulation, which don't cause anything, right? And then we have all the spikes in between, which are, you know, caused by, and we have a Jacobian matrix between these guys, but it's a multi-path Jacobian matrix. If I take any one of these things, if I look at the dependency of the timing of this spike on the timing of this spike, I end up with a multi-path thing, right? They could be directly connected. You know, this neuron could directly affect this neuron, but this neuron could talk to this neuron, which then talks to that neuron. So it's kind of like a sum of paths, right? It's like in a path integral thing, kind of thing, where you have to sum all the different ways whereby something can affect something else. So I think we see a lot of similar mathematical structures in thinking about this that we see in physics. So in order to turn this into a proper theory, I think we have to turn it into a temporal infimax spiking theory, which involves this Jacobian matrix have each DTK by DTL is potentially a sum of different possible causal paths. You know, just like, you know, you can hear the same thing from many different people, but it could have one source, right? Just goes through different paths in the graph. So, can we kill the light? Oh, right. I'm actually done now, but I just wanted to show you the slide I showed you at the beginning again. Do I have to do it again? Oh, okay. Well, all I really wanted to show you is the slide that I showed you before, where we've done a calculation of how this delta W depends on the delta. We did a simple simulation where how delta W depends on delta T in two cases, one where we had the learning rule, which was the gradient rule, which we calculated with that horrible inverse of the Jacobian timing matrix, and then the natural gradient where we multiplied by this approximate inverse Hessian. And what you see is that the pure gradient rule doesn't give you the sharp discontinuity, but when we do the natural gradient, we get the sharp discontinuity. So this was something that we were quite excited about. Because qualitatively, this looks a lot like, and so these are simulations of, you know, like some neurons down here and some neurons down here, up here, which are emitting spikes, and the spikes are affecting each other. Based on the relative timing of these things, we're calculating the delta W's, and we do a scatter plot. That's what we get for the gradient rule. That's what we get for the natural gradient rule. We get the abrupt transition. The thing which is different between this rule and the experiment is that it's approximately shifted by 17 milliseconds, which is actually the rise time of the EPSP in our simulation, which is actually ridiculously large. But so this isn't really a very good match with data in that sense. And the transition between potentiation and depression occurs at synchrony in the experiment. In our thing, it occurs when the things are offset by the rise time of the EPSP. So this is a bad thing. But I think it's a mismatch between the model. I think the principle might be right, but this is a mismatch between the model and reality, because the spike response model is kind of like a feed-forward filter model where you have delta pulses coming in and they affect these delta pulses and the output through these response functions, these linear response functions. So it's kind of like a feed-forward network, right? It treats the neuron as a feed-forward network, but we know that there's these back-propagating action potentials, and these are actually the things which help to open the calcium channels, which help to create these molecular signals which cause the LTP and at the synapses. So the biophysical story is much more complicated than what our spike response model can capture. And possibly if we change our model to incorporate to make a more accurate model of what the neuron's actually doing, we might be able to get this thing to be centered on the zero offset, because the information in biology is flowing, the spikes are flowing in both directions. And in our spike response model, they're kind of flowing only from synapse to soma with like a time delay. So that's the end of the talk. I guess what I'm really trying to push here is that I think we should build a mutual information across time spiking network with energy constraints, and then maybe we'd have something like a advance in trying to understand what the brain is doing and how to build little devices. That's it.